Part 9 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled The Magical Defeat of Evil.
I am sure that it will be understandable if the nature of a considerable context will have to be created, because we will have to decide, first of all, if we can. We might not be able to, but we can attempt to decide what is evil, and then what kind of evil can be effectively combated or defeated, and what kind perhaps cannot, and a number of related questions. But in order to do that, I might wish to begin with some considerations that have to do with our whole philosophy concerning magic and Gnostic magic that we have been employing here. No doubt many of you will recall from our first discussion and thereafter, we tried to define from our point of view magic as the attempted breakthrough, if you don't mind that overused colloquial word, of consciousness, largely by way of the imagination and the will, into a realm of reality that is different from the one that is ordinarily available to our consciousness. In other words, magic is a way in which we enter a non-ordinary state of consciousness, a non-ordinary reality, and in various ways endeavor to profit from that experience. We also said, I believe, that within a Gnostic context, that kind of a magical activity is particularly useful and valuable because it addresses itself to what may be called for our purposes the intermediate regions or the intermediate worlds. The Gnostics would probably have called them aeons, which exist between our material manifestation and ultimate transcendence. That such things exist, that such realms or worlds exist, may be news to some people, although I doubt it that it is great news to anyone here, because I think the simple-minded notion that there is sort of just ourselves here and then God there and nothing in between is probably not the sort of notion that most of us entertain, although it is no doubt one to which many people adhere. And so it is very important for a person of Gnostic aspirations in various ways to reach out into that intermediate territory and to achieve a certain degree of familiarity therewith. Why? Because that is the territory that we travel through to our destination. And if we are not acquainted with that territory, then undoubtedly our journey will not be a very successful one. A particular sort of specialized example of that coming from another, albeit related religious tradition, is the famous bardo of the Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhists, which is a discipline, both theoretical and practical, which discloses, in that case, primarily to the dying person, the nature of the territory which, in consciousness, that person will have to travel through in order to get to the ultimate light of Buddhahood. And while that particular discipline is designed for the travel that is undertaken when the body is put aside, it is well understood in Tibetan Buddhism as well that after death bardo is not the only bardo. There are others. There is a dream bardo, for instance. There are meditational bardos. In other words, there are ways of magically extending ourselves and traveling through the regions which are not dependent on that rather dramatic event that we refer to as death. In fact, I'm reasonably sure that an informed practitioner of Vajrayana Buddhism would agree with the Gnostic notion that if some skill, some facility has not been acquired with these matters prior to death, then one cannot expect much good to occur after death. In other words, we have to practice for the trip right now. And this, from the Gnostic point of view, might of course be considered a magical practice. Now, within this overall context, we come up now against a proposition and a situation that, at least at first sight, doesn't quite fit the picture that I have thus far sketched. Because the issue of evil is one that pertains not only and even not perhaps primarily to these intermediate worlds wherein the magical travel occurs, but rather it is a reality that pervades pretty much everything from the transcendental level on downward, right into and onto our physical existence, our physical level. C.G. Jung, to whom I like to refer as often as possible, said that one of the main reasons why one might wish to become interested in the teachings and in the practices of the Gnostics is exactly because they were some of the few people in the history of the world who have taken evil seriously. And Jung, from his psychological point of view, felt that he was certainly justified in taking evil seriously because he encountered it with such power and with such frequency in the minds, in the psyches with whom he dealt. And since he considered psychic reality an extremely powerful reality, he felt that he had first-hand proof of the existence of evil at the level of the psyche. At the physical level, perhaps not quite as much proof was required because the presence of evil is so evident and so readily recognizable. Still, we need to come to some recognition of what we mean by the term. If one looks up a dictionary definition of evil, which at least once in the course of my lecturing I did, a good dictionary will list a multitude of meanings for that word, some closely connected and some more vaguely related to each other. Among these are, first, something that is morally bad or wrong, wicked or depraved. Take your choice. Second, something harmful or injurious. Third, something unlucky and disastrous. Fourth, something that causes harm, pain, and disaster. Well, none of these would probably totally cover the picture as I see it, but they do point at least in certain directions. The truth is that all of these have at one time or the other been definitions of what constitutes evil. The Greek word kakon, denoting evil, is obviously one of those archaic words resembling baby talk, and I don't think I have to go into detail any further. The issue of moral evil is of course of later origin and significance, and the fact that it's put first in a current or almost current dictionary of course indicates the influence of sort of the ethical monotheistic overtones of our culture. But let's say I would just probably explore at this point two major prongs of the pitchfork which is probably an appropriate symbol. One of these being that life on Earth has always been hard and at least in part terrifying. Oh, no doubt, in some mythologies, a paradisical condition is postulated or retrojected into the distant past, but the objective existence of such a condition can in no way be proven. So I think we are quite justified in assuming that earthly life has always been filled with difficult and nasty things. The other side, of course, is, from a Gnostic point of view, probably more important, and that is that evil is something that, with some degree of efficiency, opposes and retards and obstructs what we, as individual human spirits and souls, should do, namely, to achieve a greater consciousness, to reconnect ourselves with our ultimate source, and eventually to be able to return to that ultimate source. Now, there are obviously forces, conscious forces, so it would seem in many cases, that oppose that effort. Were that not so, we would have all, or at least most of us, would have achieved our goal already. So we are working against a certain opposition, which manifests at the physical level in certain ways, at the level of mind in other ways. Now, it's easy, again, to attempt to evade this issue, as we always do, and a frequent evasion is that at the physical level, as long as things are natural, as long as they are within a certain system of balance, we cannot really speak about evil. That the evil, this is the one of the most recent approaches to evil. And it's rather kind of the paradisical archetype is present within it. Just like the old Garden of Eden paradigm or archetype is that there was a paradise at one time, and everything was going fairly well there until Adam and Eve, of course, Eve being the chief villain because she started it out, you know, sort of messed it up. And then it wasn't paradise anymore. That's the older story. The newer story is very similar to that, only it's been transmogrified into a more contemporary and more secular setting. The contemporary version of that is not that at one time there was paradise, but that right now there still is or could be paradise, and you and I are Adam and Eve rather than Adam and Steve or whatever the case may be, as to remember the dear Mr. Falwell's, Reverend Falwell's, we wouldn't want to take that away from his statement, you know. You know his famous statement, it was against gays, who else? I mean, those are his constant affliction. You know, he said, in paradise it wasn't Adam and Steve, it was Adam and Eve. I think he turned it the other way around. Well, I'm not so good at imitating him. So, in other words, you and I are Adam and Eve, and we are messing up paradise right now. See? That's the contemporary version. Why are we missing it right now? Because paradise consists in ecological balance. And we are the one who mess it up. And therefore, we are once again, just like before, once again, we are the destroyers of paradise. Why is that so? Because I think that so many of us just love to be guilty, or at least feel guilty. And so we come up with, so this is like the contemporary paradise scenario. Now, just think of that. We are the ones who mess up the natural paradise. Okay. Some of you will remember this story because it's such a favorite story of mine, but it's short and it's really worth remembering. And that's the story of my dear, dear friend, the stink ant of the Cameroon forest. Megaloponera foetena, the smelly ant, the smelly large ant. That's what it means in Latin. And here is the story of the stink ant. Deep in the Cameroonian rainforest of West Central Africa, there lives a floor-dwelling ant known as Megaloponera foetens, or more commonly the stink ant. This large ant, indeed one of the very few capable of emitting a cry audible to the human ear, and now when ants start screaming, then I'll start screaming too. But let's say the one of very few capable of emitting a cry audible to the human ear survives by foraging for food among the fallen leaves and undergrowth of the extraordinarily rich rainforest floor. On occasion, while thus foraging, one of these ants will become infected by inhaling the microscopic spore of a fungus from the genus Tomentella, millions of which rain down upon the forest floor from somewhere in the canopy above. Now, mind you, this is in that famous paradisical condition called the rainforest. The rainforest. That's the super paradise of the present paradisical fantasy. Now, that's where this takes place, in the rainforest. Upon being inhaled, this spore lodges itself inside the ant's tiny brain and immediately begins to grow, quickly fomenting bizarre behavioral changes in its ant host. The creature appears troubled and confused, and presently, for the first time in its life, it leaves the forest floor and begins an arduous climb up the stalks of vines and ferns. Driven on and on by the still-growing fungus, the ant finally achieves a seemingly prescribed height, whereupon, utterly spent, it impales the plant with its mandibles and thus affixed waits to die. Ants that have met their doom in this fashion are quite a common sight in certain sections of the rainforest. The fungus, for its part, lives on. It continues to consume the brain, moving on through the rest of the nervous system and eventually through all the soft tissue that remains of the ant. After approximately 2 weeks, a spike-like protrusion erupts from out of what had once been the ant's head. Growing to a length of about an inch and a half, the spike features a bright orange tip, heavy laden with spores, which now begin to rain down onto the forest floor for other unsuspecting ants to inhale. Paradise, benign, kindly nature, well, it may contribute, this particular dreadful event may all work within a system of ultimate balance. But can it, even by the widest stretch of one's imaginative definitions, can it be called good? No. Quite to the contrary. I think it's the most incredible example of malign, awful evil dwelling in this so-called paradise. And moreover, in no way is it caused by humans. Not at all. Not at all. Not at all. So that should perhaps give us a little indication that right at the physical level of nature, there are a lot of things that are terrible, that are wrong, that are injurious, and that I think with considerable justification may be called evil. But of course there is a tendency in our minds that is very reluctant to consider these things. It's very reluctant to consider such horrible things, whether they appear in the rainforest or whether they appear anywhere else. And to the extent that our minds address themselves to such nasty things of one kind or the other, they will do so only with the proviso that we can convince ourselves that in some way or the other, at some point, it is probably within our power to change these things and make them right. Which, of course, is an illusion. Quite an illusion. How are you ever going to change the relationship of that spore and the stink ant? Well, perhaps you don't particularly wish to. And I wouldn't blame you, but horrible it is nevertheless. So you see, this kind of mentality, this kind of view of reality, everything is fine, and what is not fine, we shall fix. This is pretty much what the great and wonderful American philosopher and psychologist William James referred to as healthy-mindedness. He sort of had his own little system of psychological types. I will not go into that, but one he called healthy-minded. That's sort of the optimistic, one might kind of say the traditional 19th century and early 20th century American, a healthy-minded fellow. Everything is all right with the world, and what is not all right, we shall attend to and we shall fix it. However, William James himself, while he certainly diagnosed that healthy-mindedness, was not unaware of its blindness. This is what William James wrote in his Varieties of Religious Experience. There is no doubt that healthy-mindedness is inadequate as a philosophical doctrine, because the evil facts which it positively refuses to account for are a genuine portion of reality, and they may, after all, be the best key to life's significance and possibly the only openers of our eyes to the deepest level of truth. That's William James. So if you had an idea that James was sort of this cockeyed optimist, you were wrong. Therefore, this is certainly something one needs to consider. Pure optimism and healthy-mindedness just really will not do. Now, of course, people have considered evil, and especially the religious traditions always address themselves to it in some fashion. I will now very quickly go through something that, again, some of you may have heard me enumerate at another time, the major ways in which primarily religious traditions have tried to explain evil. The oldest, and I'll just do this very quickly, because it's a good framework and good background. The oldest probably, and therefore sort of the most primitive view, is one that I would call the monistic view of the origin of evil, which sees evil as the result of universally present and generally divine action. This is chiefly embodied in, we find it very, very clearly embodied in the religions of ancient Mesopotamia, Sumeria, Babylon, Assyria, and thereabouts. But, let's see, it's the one that declares that physical and moral evil, such as sickness, death, deformity, suffering, psychic pain, anger, greed, cruelty, are all part of a divine order. Or if you want to look at it in ancient terms, they have been placed on earth by the gods. Now, it takes a certain kind of rather undifferentiated, I think, consciousness to be able to cope with and to live with that kind of concept. It's really it's at the back of the concept that the Lord makes his rain to fall on the just and on the unjust. But one needs to add, of course, just a little more often will that rain fall on the just, because the unjust has stolen the just's umbrella. You know that take on it. But that it all comes from the same place. But the tension of moral ambivalence that such a view induces becomes just a little bit too much for the individual to take. To envision a greater reality which governs our lives totally and governs the lives of the universe, which visits randomly and capriciously us with either good or evil according to its particular predilection of the moment, is highly disturbing. And so humanity, while it may possess this kind of an undifferentiated view in the beginning, moves on to others primarily because it can't take that kind of a view. It drives a person batty. And so it comes to another, which is dualism, especially radical dualism, which postulates two principles opposed to each other. This makes a little more sense. So there is one principle that is responsible for the good, there's another principle that's responsible for the bad. At least we don't have to assume that it all comes from the same source. And it's just a little bit the same kind of a situation at a more personal level of children who, let's say, have very capricious and very undisciplined, nasty parents. One minute they are really nice to the child and the other minute they are awful to the child. So affliction and blessing both comes from the same parent. The results of that in a child's psychology are by no means desirable. And so we come now to a dual view. The principal example that in religions is Zoroastrianism, the religion of Zarathustra in Persia, where Ahura Mazda is the lord of light and of goodness versus Angra Manyu, the lord of darkness and of evil and of lies. All good things and virtues come from the good God, all evil, unpleasant things from the bad one. This influenced all later developments in religion, and that is certainly one way of escaping that primordial tension of the earlier view. Then the third one, and I'll come back to this one, because this is rather along the line of the Gnostic view, is what might be called a qualified dualism. And in this picture, of which I will explain in greater detail when I come to the demiurgic concept, let's say the soul comes forth from its original condition. It falls or descends from heavenly beatitude and comes to inhabit a body derived from material nature. This concept was also quite common. And what we have here is a duality. But the duality is qualified in the sense that it is a much more complex and sophisticated explanation, indicating that the existential condition within which we find ourselves is alienated from the supreme reality, which is good, and that the managing and at time creating agencies of this lesser realm are imperfect and alienated beings. And the human coming into such a world, therefore, is in a singularly difficult predicament. That's sort of a preliminary view of the qualified dualism, which we find, I think, in our, at least in my Gnostic philosophy as well. The fourth view is, of course, that evil is the product of the primordial perversity or disobedience of humans. In the earlier ones, it's always the nature of the divine or the nature of reality, the fabric of reality in some way that is responsible for evil. Here, it is taken out of that and it's placed onto the human. And this, of course, is rooted in the Genesis concept, which I just referred to, of paradise and how paradise was undone by Adam and Eve rather than by Adam and Steve. You might say, why do I even talk about this sort of thing? Because, after all, not too many people, and especially I don't think that even one person in this room, takes the Genesis myth with literal seriousness. Well, of course not. But you know what? Even though certainly the normative circles of our culture don't take the Genesis myth seriously or literally, it still continues to influence our culture. Why is that so? Well, I think depth, once again, depth psychology, which has been here for an entire century, you know, since Freud started right around 1900, should have taught us that. Because the concepts that we consciously hold and believe in our minds are not the ones often that truly and ultimately and effectively influence and run our lives. There are other factors involved. And so it seems that the Genesis myth, with its production of guilt, with the notion that the bad things that go on in this world and in our lives are our fault, is tremendously powerfully ingrained in the psyche of our culture. We are a guilt culture par excellence. And if we don't find anything realistically suitable to feel guilty about, then we'll feel guilty about something else. We'll feel guilty about something that is unrealistic or even unreal. But we have to find something to feel guilty about. And certainly this mythology works into that very heavily. In fact, you're probably familiar with that. Doggone, in which I think in her book, Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, Elaine Pagels, who is, of course, rather dear to our hearts because of her splendid book, The Gnostic Gospels, tells the story that she was on some academic assignment in Africa quite a while back, several decades, and she was in the Sudan, which is not a nice place. I think it's gotten worse since that time. And then she was holding discussions with a government official who was of a particular tribe, the Dinka tribe, and the government official told her how important the creation myth was to his people, and how so much of their culture and their behavior still really revolved around the ideas of that creation myth. So she listened to that, and then she went back to her hotel room, to make her longer story a little bit shorter. And there she picked up a copy of Time magazine, which had just come. And she opened up, rather like I often do. Somehow I'm an addict to letters to the editor. And that's the first thing I always look at, you know. I don't know why, but I do. It's just one of these compulsions. It probably comes from Adam and Eve. In any event, that's what she did. And there were letters to the editor there which referred to an earlier issue that had to do with cultural and moral changes in America, especially in terms of sexual morality and so forth. And she said that there were a lot of letters, I think every last one of the letters referred back to the Genesis story in order to sort out the moral ambiguities of our present cultural situation. They all went back to Adam and Eve and things like that. And she said, my word, you know, we are not that much different from the Dinka tribe. Our minds are also run by our Genesis myth. And so, you know, these things have very deep influences. And I just indicated a few minutes ago as to how these things transmogrify themselves into new manifestations. I bet you there are not too many people, especially of the little green men and women, you know, the eco-fascists and their, it's only the, you know, the extreme branch, but let's say of the whole kind of ecological movement, I think there are very few of them would ever think about the fact that their myth, which has assumed really a religious significance to many, is an exact translation into contemporary and secular terms of the Genesis myth. And it settles us with a version of the original sin. Mm-hmm. We are the humans, we are the spoilers, we are the hackers, we are the hewers, we are the destroyers, and therefore we are guilty. Isn't that just wonderful? We find another way to be guilty. In any event, the Adam and Eve myth, which makes the human responsible for evil, is still very much part of our thinking. The fifth view of the origin of evil also places evil into the category of human creation, but it assigns it not to human sin and disobedience, but rather to human ignorance and error. Ignorance, in Sanskrit called avidya, mistakes the phenomenal appearance of the world for reality, and thus the human soul becomes enmeshed in the world of change, tied to the wheel of birth and death, from which it can be liberated only by disciplines of inner realization. You probably have come to already to the conclusion that this is, of course, a major, again, I don't like to use that word, but I use it just the same, a major paradigm in the spirituality of the East, particularly in Hinduism and in other traditions derived therefrom. It's really quite a sophisticated view. It's quite, in a sense, you might say it's quite a psychological view, because what it says is that our wrongful understanding of what is real and our unfortunate ability to make and to be involved in sort of our own unreality, our own Maya, is the cause of the evil. So that we make the evil because we make an evil world for ourselves. Now, I'm giving this a very psychological twist, but that is really at the back of it. It's quite sophisticated and I would say quite interesting. And that pretty much covers the five ways in which humanity tried to explain and tried to deal with evil. Now, I'll come to the particular mythos which has been used by my spiritual ancestors, the Gnostics, and will show you now for a minute how that fits into the picture. What we need to keep in mind is that the Gnostic thinking, and consequently much of Gnostic writing, as you certainly can prove to yourself by reading Nag Hammadi library or any other Gnostic sources, is primarily mythological. Now, if you don't feel very warm toward mythology, then you will not like that. But I think that kind of 19th century and early 20th century critique of mythology has pretty much gone by the wayside, where people thought that mythic thinking was a kind of archaic way of dealing with reality. That people would make up myths about the rising and the setting of the sun, or the growing of the vegetation, and things that you find in Fraser's Golden Bough, or things like that. It's a preposterous notion. Archaic people, so-called primitive people, simple people, are maybe simple, but they're not stupid. Not that kind of simple. They don't need to come up with a big, complex myth to explain to themselves how a grain falls into the ground and then grows into a stalk of wheat. It's nonsense. I lived among simple people in my childhood in Hungary and so forth, and they would have laughed you in the face. I mean, we know how that happens, you know. So why, then, is the presence, and I got to go quickly with this sort of thing, with myth so powerful at certain times in history, and maybe it's coming back to some degree, at least in some circles today. It's not at all because of what this kind of 19th century thinking made it out to be, but because there are some issues in life. There are some conundrums and perplexities and situations in life which cannot be profitably dealt with and understood save by way of the myth. Well, you can deal with them by other means. But the mythic way is the most helpful. So you might say where a sensate, a physical approach fails, where a logical, mental approach fails, what is left is the mythical one. So when you see all sorts of teachers of spiritual things, in the Middle East or in India or in among the Sufis, which would be Middle East and ancient Judaism and so forth, when they, including of course the Bible, especially Jesus in his parables and so forth, they try to teach something of a very subtle, very other, very magical nature to people. Then how do they do that? They say, all right, my friend, let me tell you a story. You see? And somehow in the course of listening and apprehending that story, a little bit of a light begins to dawn in that dark head of ours. And at the end, people say, aha, I think I understand. But you see, it's not the kind of I understand that would come about as the result of a 1, 2, 3 reductionistic, logical, kind of quasi-scientific way of dealing with things. That's the trouble, incidentally, with much of this sort of 19th and early 20th century quasi-spirituality, occultism, and things like that, which to some degree, of course, has been inherited by the New Age, as I like to pronounce it sometimes, which makes a science out of something that ain't, if you don't mind me putting it that way, and then goes up or down the line. 1, 2, 3. Oh, there is a physical plane, and there is an astral plane, and there is a mental plane, and there is an airplane, and, you know, blah, 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 all this sort of thing. Whenever this 1, 2, 3 kind of layer cake explanations come up, I begin to say, oh, oi, 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 you know, because they break down. It is for the most part, it's an inappropriate approach to something. And the reason for it is that there is no real magical sense, magical thinking involved. For magical things, you don't need to think like a scientist or like an engineer. For magical things, you need to think like a poet. Because as Shakespeare says, the poet's eye in a fine frenzy rolling. What is that? It's a change of consciousness. It's an altering of consciousness. It's the extraordinary consciousness which now addresses itself to the cognition of extraordinary things. Is this so doggone difficult to apprehend that ordinary things need an ordinary way to be understood? Extraordinary things need an extraordinary way to be understood. It should be simple, but we still don't do it. And part of that is, I think, that especially since the 18th century, maybe even a little bit earlier, it has been drummed into our heads culturally so much that poetry and art and these sorts of things are not truly real. It's nice for entertainment. But the real things are the ones that you can figure out mathematically, and that you can somehow connect with sensate experience. See, prior to that, the attitude was exactly the reverse of that. Now, there is, for instance, a great deal of evidence indicating, and I can tell you the sources where you can find it, that the dramas of Shakespeare were not only inspired by, but, let's say, consciously saturated with hermetic philosophy. You might almost say that somehow a decision was made somewhere that the Corpus Hermeticum and its teachings, which were brought to England at the time of the Renaissance by Giordano Bruno from Italy, need to be made available to people. And that the best way to make them available will be in the form of drama and of art, because that's how they work best. I am not one of the people who say that Francis Bacon or anybody else like that wrote Shakespeare. I couldn't care less. And you know what I found? Of course, you heard me say that before. Most of these people who will go on and on and on for years and for a lifetime trying to convince other people that Francis Bacon or somebody else, Lord this or that, wrote Shakespeare, or a committee of Elizabethan statesmen or somebody like that wrote Shakespeare, you know what? They hardly ever read Shakespeare. These people who say that. They don't know the Shakespearean corpus, because what excites them is the conspiracy theory. They couldn't care less about the dramas of Shakespeare. If they knew what Shakespeare really wrote, then they could see that there is a magnificent higher a spiritual didactic effort going on here. Now, how did I get to Shakespeare with all this? I don't know, but I think I'll be able to trace my steps back by some kind of thread of Ariadne. And the thread of Ariadne is the issue that there are some aspects of life that can be best approached by way of mythic and poetic modalities, because they are so different from the material and prosaic and logical intellectual categories in which our lower minds operate. And that is why the Gnostic approach to this, of the origin of evil, is also mythic. Now let me go very quickly with that. The whole issue is, and most of you know this and will consider it a redundancy, of course, is that the world of physicality and of psyche, that is, the world of body and of mind, within which we live and which lives in us, has been provided not by the ultimate reality, but by an intermediate power or demiurge, demiurgos, half-maker, which incidentally is a concept that goes back to Plato. Plato, in his work, The Laws, whatever that translates like into Greek, so not in the Timaeus, not in the others, says that, and I quote, that the universal God, that is not his word, but the ultimate God, the good, and now are the words of Plato himself, has appointed ministers to preside over the various functions of the cosmos, down to the last fraction of them with infinitesimal exactness. In other words, the lesser worlds have been fabricated, put together by lesser beings. These are demiurgoi. Now, this notion was well nigh universally held in classical antiquity. Moreover, it was not restricted to so-called pagans like Plato, but was in fact a prominent factor in so-called monotheistic religions up to a certain extent, such as Judaism and Zoroastrianism. How does it appear there? It appears by way of the angels. What are angels? Angels are messengers. In other words, these whole worlds and hierarchies of beings, and the further down they come, the more material and perhaps materialistic they are. Now, one of the inevitable consequences of the recognition that they are such intermediate creative and administrative agencies is the myth that declares that they are not all good and helpful, but that at least some of them may be unwise, unkind, and arrogant, and even some of them downright evil. Of course, the fall of the angels of Lucifer, who was an archangel originally, the whole theology about the fallen angels has something to do with this. I don't want to go into it more and more, but let me just say that this, of course, appears all down the line, clear into the New Testament, and that is why the Gnostics had their own interpretation of this, where, for instance, in the Gospel of John, the 12th chapter, Jesus speaks of the speaks of the Demiurge, as far as I am concerned, when he says, "Now is the judgment of the world. Now shall the ruler of this world be cast out." Which of course means, and this is canonical gospel, that he comes and he is going to undo what the power that rules over this world has established. Similarly, many statements of St. Paul, the apostle whom Elaine Pagels has properly called the Gnostic Paul in one of her books, indicate that he shared this view. So we find, for instance, at one point in the letter to the Galatians, where Paul writes, you are probably all familiar with this, "So when we were children, we were serving under the elemental powers of the world." When we grew up spiritually, then we didn't. And then the famous one from the 6th chapter of his letter to the Ephesians, "For we are wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the world of this darkness, against the spirits of wickedness in high places." So here then is the Gnostic view of the origin of evil. Now, all right. Now comes the big question, what we were really supposed to talk about, and that means what to do about it. What is the magic then against evil, and the defense against evil from Gnostic point of view? Now, we need to understand from a Gnostic perspective, which is really the perspective of classical antiquity, we live in three worlds. To wit, the material world, one. Second, the psychic world, or the world of mind, and third, the world of spirit. The first two, namely the material world and the world of mind, are not evil. I repeat, not evil. But they are contaminated by evil. They are mixed with evil. Many, many statements of this exist, and an interesting mythologem in that regard, which appears in various ways, and certainly appears in the cosmological, cosmogonic myth of the Gnostic prophet Mani, also, is the notion that somehow, at some point, the light has been swallowed up by the darkness. The good has been swallowed up by the bad. And from then on, the two were mixed. The two were coexistent in the same locale. It's in the Greek mythology where Dionysus, the god, is torn apart by the Titans, and then at some point he's also burned. In any event, the portions of his body are swallowed up by the dark Titans. In a Manichaean teaching, the primal man, the Anthropos, and his five sons, the first emanation of the light, is swallowed up by the armies of darkness. And what is going on now is still the rescue operation of trying to bring out these sparks of light that have been swallowed up by the darkness. Therefore, in these first two worlds, namely material and mental, we are likely to encounter evil in all kinds of forms. The most common are what? Selfishness and self-involvement. Now, I'm not saying anything new. There is practically no spiritual or religious tradition, and some secular teachings as well, which will point that out. That selfishness and self-involvement, self-seeking are not good things. But once again, the Gnostic has a curious twist on this. What do they call it nowadays? A spin? Maybe not that. And what is that? The problem with the Demiurge, the intermediate power that messes everything up in Gnostic mythology, is precisely that. That it is selfish, self-involved, and arrogant, and because of its self-involvement, this being has excluded consciousness of the true reality, has become forgetful, Yaldabaoth forgets his own mother, who is Sophia. And he says, I am the only one, I am the only God, and there is nothing above me. Then Sophia shouts down from on high and says, you lie, Samael. You know, in one particular, I think it's in the Apocryphon of John, or one of the Nag Hammadi scriptures. It's mythic, but it tells a story. In other words, when the more we are involved with our ego, the more we duplicate the primordial fault of the demiurge. In us, the ego becomes the demiurge. Not even the ultimate God, not even the messengers of light can do away with the demiurge. In fact, everything would fall apart if they probably did, because in his own bumbling way, he keeps things together. You know, but and same way we cannot do away with the ego, but the more inflated, the more self-involved that ego consciousness becomes, the more we participate in the foolishness of the foolish powers in the universe. Okay? So the Gnostic ties selfishness up with a cosmic and transcendental fault. But that is why selfishness is evil. Because it replicates and it duplicates something that messes up everything. And as the demiurge's blindness, foolishness, self-involvement, arrogance creates a barrier between our consciousness and the consciousness of the ultimate, so our own internal demiurge does the same thing. Now, you know, you may say, well, why do I have to have this kind of a convoluted explanation? Well, maybe you don't. But on the other hand, I think it's a little bit more convincing explanation, at least to me, it may not be to you, than just to say one should not be selfish and self-involved because it's not nice. Well, what do I care if it's nice or not? Or what do you care if it's nice or not? We do all kinds of things that are not nice. Maybe we shouldn't, but we do, you know. So what is this telling us, if you don't want to go along with that specific kind of explanation? It is telling us that when we continue to dwell in that inflated, self-involved ego of ours, we participate in a monumental cosmic perversity, not only of our own. We participate in a very fundamental, ultimate wrongness. So what we do then is really not just little personal wrong, but it's very, very wrong. And so from this very, very wrong thing, we need to extricate ourselves. Every time we manage to extricate ourselves from it, even a little bit, we patched up some of the dark, evil holes, the dark holes of the universe. Every time somebody escapes selfishness, even just for one action or so, he made it a little bit better in the universal structure. So if I'm generally rather disdainful of this kind of sentimentality that goes, I want to make the world a better place to live, you know, and heaven knows by what means. If you really want to make the world a better place, diminish your own unconsciousness, diminish your own selfishness. That will make it a better place. Jung was about the only one I know of in modern times, certainly within the psychological disciplines, but even philosophical, who recognized that he had his own way of explaining it, which had to be psychological. Because he said that whatever consciousness we can adduce to this so largely unconscious world will light it up. Every little light will make, so to say, more light of consciousness. But this is really a translation, let's say, into modern psychological terms of the Gnostic concept. So we can best protect ourselves against evil by diminishing the inflated ego. Why is this so? one could go on about it, you know, to a great extent. But let's just take little evils, using the Webster definition of evil, as something injurious, as something unpleasant, as something onerous. The more self-involved you are, the more miserable you will make yourself to begin with, and by way of that, probably all those people who are around you. Our own misery is the result of our own self-created egotistical universe. As soon as we are able to see out of it, it's like an incredible weight lifts off our shoulders. And at the moment I start not thinking about me and my toothache, one of my present problems, and my bills, and my this and my that, it's incredible. I mean, it's better than taking an entire bottle of pain pills. You know, it's just as simple as that. But it has to happen. And how is it going to happen? If you have lived for a little while, and I think then you will agree with me that it isn't easily done. Because this sort of just cycles around like the wheel of becoming, and to break out of it is not easy. That is why really all the wise people have always said, just look around and see somebody who is worse off than you are. See somebody who needs something that you may be able to some degree to supply. Because this is somehow one of the best ways, or perhaps the best way, to break out of that bubble. You see, once again, compassion, kindness, helpfulness, whatever you wish to call it, caritas, the charity, it's not just to be done because it's nice. The heck with nice. It's to be done because in addition to everything else, it's a stratagem to break out of the confinements of the ego. But the ego is tricky, because it may, and it certainly does, mingle that very effort again with its own egotism. It's very difficult to escape a demiurge. So you try to be compassionate. You try to be good. Okay, I'm going to donate so many days or whatever to a charity. I'm going to be in the soup kitchen or whatever. But the little demiurge rides along with you to the soup kitchen, you know. And then what will he do? He'll pat you on the back and he'll say, oh, aren't we a good boy? We are doing something good. We are making the world a better place. And we are practicing compassion. We are being charitable. And consequently, aren't we wonderful? You see? It'll do that. It'll do it every time. So one has to be extremely careful, and it requires a tremendous amount of self-observation, a great deal of self-reflection, inquiring into the depth of our motives. Is there self-seeking there or not? And another helpful thing with that is, in this respect, one thing that helps is the less abstraction you employ in your good deeds, in your good works, the more concrete they are. You want to help somebody specific. You know? Now, of course, that's sometimes not easy to do. I don't have much, but I give money to good causes too, because they need that more than they could use my own bumbling efforts. You know, I don't know how to do anything that would really help these charitable causes. I would be a burden. They would have to kick me out or something. But be careful about causes. Be careful. Why? Because they are abstractions. And they themselves become an ego-feeding and an ego-building situation. Because, again, the thing will be, I am the guy who is involved in this good cause. You see? I am the one who helps the revolution in Timbuktu, which of course will probably bring a more malign dictator to the fore than the previous one, and so forth. But whatever the case may be, there is a great danger in abstract causes, because they automatically feed the ego, because where does an abstract cause exist? It doesn't exist in reality, otherwise it wouldn't be abstract, right? It would be concrete. An abstract cause exists in the mind. And the mind is a dangerous place. It's a dangerous agora. It's a dangerous plaza where all kinds of nasty things go on. And that is why the way to be compassionate, the way to be good, is in as direct a way as possible. And without the involvement in abstractions, in abstract causes that lend themselves again to the building of that ego. Now, I would be remiss if I omitted this at the last occasion. What about spiritual wickedness in high places? Or as some people translate it, in the air, you know, what about demons? What about nasty things that are not physical and that are not necessarily in our egos? Don't they exist? Well, all I can say is there is evidence that they do exist. And if you look, for instance, into the Gnostic teachings of Valentinus and so forth, he even speaks of Satan in addition to the Demiurge. And in fact, he says that the satanic forces are worse than the Demiurge because they have not forgotten the real God, but they are against him. You know? Conscious antagonism toward the good. Well, with the Demiurge, it's only forgetful stupidity and arrogance. If you want to apply it to the individual, you can. The ego is not necessarily the worst thing that we have within our psyches. There are demons in our psyches. There are terrible things there, terrible possibilities, which are not just ego-driven, but heaven knows where they come from. Heaven knows how they fell from heaven. And all you need to do is look into the annals of crime, look into the Jeffrey Dahmers, look into some of the things that go on, or for that matter, on a massive scale, look into the Stalins and the Pol Pots and the Adolf Eichmanns and things like that. Is that just ego? Well, Hitler certainly had a big ego, but there are other things going on, real nastiness, a real deep, dark evil that is very, very difficult to approach or to explain by any other means. And of course, against these, the two things that can be done with these things. When they haven't gotten very close to one yet, then one needs to defend oneself against them. How does one defend against them? By the cultivation of the sacred, the cultivation of the symbolic life, the cultivation of the divine. The more one has that, the less active they are. The less they will be able to get to you. I can't, and it's not my purpose to convince somebody who is not affinitized to certain symbols of the sacred that might be important and meaningful to me, to adopt the same ones. They might not mean anything to that kind of a person. But something should be there. So one needs to think, what is the best symbolization of something good, of something wonderful that you can think of and that you may have? Maybe it's the picture of your mother. That can be a holy picture too. It doesn't just have to be Blessed Virgin Mary or Mother Sophia. It could be your mother or whoever, but something. And have some center, some symbolization of the good of the sacred with you and around you in your place. If you move into a new room or things like that, don't go to sleep for one night without putting up something that is good and sacred to you, that is part of your, that relates to your inner life. Otherwise, take things with you of that sort when you are traveling. And then these things will be far less likely to come to you. There are, of course, even nastier things than that, and that's where exorcisms and things of that sort come in. You may say, oh dear, medieval awful stuff. Well, they are necessary. I've been just reading a rather interesting little book, if you come across it. You may not agree with a lot of theory in it, but it's very interesting. It's written by an Italian priest by the name of Gabriele Amorth, and it is entitled An Exorcist Tells His Story. Father Amorth is the officially appointed chief exorcist of the city and the diocese of Rome. And he has been working in that field for quite a number of years. He learned it from his predecessor, who was another priest who was the exorcist, and his experience is very, very extensive. And he makes a very good case that this sort of activity renders a very important service, and that it's most unfortunate in different places where the church is ever more reluctant to recognize these emergencies and to train and appoint exorcists, because there is a need for getting rid of unusual, certainly not frequent, manifestations of radical evil. And so that leaves us really sort of with our own condition. How are we to treat? How are we to defend ourselves? How are we to get rid of the darkness and the evil that is around us and that is within us? And there, I think, all kinds of approaches are being taken. We have to have our own. I will not condemn any approach, especially not an approach that works. I think it is quite useful that there are religious approaches to these matters which seem to work, and even though perhaps the theology behind them may not be to our liking, that they are quite helpful to people. But of course the question always arises, what of those for whom the light of that kind of faith has gone out, and for whom the simple answers don't work, and who have seen the contradictions in these structures and who cannot resolve them? What of them, and what of them indeed? Secondly, of course, there is also, let's say, the secular option. I think that is probably the most bereft of hope. Because the totally secular outlook that does not recognize anything beyond the rational and beyond the senses is simply not able to avail itself of an adequate defense against evil. The greatest evils that have come forth, at least on a grand collective scale, in our horrible 20th century, came out in a milieu and by way of people who had become very, very secular. Hitler and the Nazis. Hitler may have shouted about providence and things like that, but there was no transcendental orientation there. There was no contact of any kind. And of course, even more so with people like Stalin and Pol Pot and Mao Zedong. There is very little hope against evil, personal or collective, in those quarters. Also, I think there is not much good that comes out of the sort of vague, imprecise notions characterized by the fuzzy thinking, the denial of the darkness that masquerades as certain kinds of spirituality today. I think the New Age phenomenon is singularly vulnerable. and I don't say this for the same reasons that the fundamentalists might say so, but it's primarily vulnerable because it denies the existence and the power of evil. If you have a rattlesnake in your room and you deny that there is a rattlesnake, then the rattlesnake is much more likely to bite you than when you recognize that it is there. It's not to be done. Denial has not done away with any kind of an unpleasant condition. And so I think these things are very, very vulnerable for this reason. What the entire New Age phenomenon needs, I think, more than anything else, is a realistic recognition of the presence of evil and how to deal with it and how to counter it, which it really does not have. Now, I need to conclude by maybe giving you a little indication of what I would think is ultimately, and again sort of primarily at a semi-poetic level, the approach of Gnosis to these matters. What is needed is the magic of Gnosis. To break through the dark vault, the inverted bowl upon which are inscribed the lights, the planets, to say no to the darkness, to the enemy, and to renounce all his works and all his pomp and all his deception, his never-ending tricks and falsehoods. No, we shall shout. I wrote this a number of years ago. I say no to you and all that you stand for, and I call to my true parent, the one far away in the distance, the great alien light, the great love from beyond, the mighty one beyond all that sense can perceive or the mind can comprehend. I call to the other, the holy other, the one out there beyond earth and beyond sky, beyond the seas and beyond the vastness of space, the one without a second, the truth without falsehood, the love without guile and without condition, the one who hears and understands, the one who liberates with might and loves with freedom, the one who shall free me from the enemy, free me from all bondage, and help me to leave this house of nothingness. He is the one, the only one, and he is my help. It's kind of little poetic statement. You may interpret it the way you wish. But I think somewhere along these lines lies the answer to Gnosis to these matters. And I thank you very much.
Copyright MMI by BC Recording. Catalog number 304409. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit Gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.